My name is Barry Shelley, and as was announced at lunch today, I work for the Salvadoran Baptist Churches with sponsorship from both the Mennonite Central Committee and the United Church of Christ, which is the church that I'm a member of. I've been there for about 2.5 years now. We'll be going back in another few weeks. Have worked up until now in a program that deals with the issue of what we call forced military recruitment, an issue that I'll talk a little bit about today, but a whole session on tomorrow. So if you're more interested in that, we can talk about that. And when I go back, I'll be more in a coordinating role for Mennonite Central Committee in Salvador. So today, what I want to do, this is the first of four sessions that I'll be doing this week on El Salvador. The fifth session will be on the global debt crisis, which also very much affects Central America. And today I want to do more, really sort of an introduction to El Salvador, what's going on there. I'm not going to go through some sort of systematic political analysis. I'm going to do some of that. I'm going to do some history. But primarily what I want to do is give you some blotches of images. Fortunately, because of some mix-up, I don't have the slides that I planned for images, but through some other ways of stories and information, we'll try to give you some impression of what it's like there, and then look at why is it like that, specifically looking at the war. Later on in the week, we'll look more specifically at the U.S. role and also the church role for North Americans in particular. So, to begin, to ask the question, what's it like in El Salvador? Let me begin by reading a story, which is a personal story that I wrote in relation to one particular experience that occurred about 2 years ago. Another abduction. Though I had been in El Salvador only 5 weeks, I was already somewhat accustomed to hearing about such incidents. At first I responded as I had to previous reports. I listened intently and quite seriously to the information, but my pain was still the generic pain of one who remains somewhat disconnected. Then I heard the name of the victim. Suddenly the story was fundamentally different. This was somebody I knew. I rushed the news over to the house of a human rights worker. I felt stunned, but managed to dodge for the moment the sense of helplessness lurking in the depths of my blurry thoughts. It was a relief to have a task on which I could focus. The message was sent to support networks in the United States. 46-year-old Maria Cristina Gomez, a school teacher, was abducted by armed men in civilian clothing at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesday, April 5th, 1989. She was teaching class at the John School in Colonia Santa Lucia, Soyapango, Department of San Salvador. The students witnessed the abduction. She was taken away in a Cherokee van. The whereabouts are not known. Telegrams and calls on her behalf should be sent to. It was around 4 p.m. We did not know at the time that it was already too late to save Christina. She had been murdered about 4 hours earlier. Witnesses in another part of town saw the killing. Christina was thrown from the Cherokee vehicle onto a pile of rubble alongside the road and shot 4 times in her head and back. In the short time she had been held, her face had been disfigured with acid and the skin on one arm had been peeled back. Christina was the divorced mother of the 4 young people with whom I live in San Salvador. While I had not yet gotten to know her well, she had impressed me deeply with her friendliness, her infectious enthusiasm, and her faithful commitment to the quest for peace and justice for the people of El Salvador. I had expressed interest in learning more about the work she was doing, and we had agreed to get together the following week to talk at greater length. Christina was known as a very capable, compassionate, and courageous woman. She was a highly respected elementary school teacher who also had served in several key roles in church educational programs. She was a founding member of Emmanuel Baptist Church in San Salvador and had been one of the organizers of an ecumenical Christian education movement in the country. In recent years, she had become very active in Andes 21 de Junio, the National Teachers Union, and CONAMUS, the National Coordination of Salvadoran Women. She headed up a weekly feminist radio program and 2 weeks earlier had served as the MC for the opening of a new clinic for women who are victims of rape and other forms of violence. I remember gazing down on Christina's corpse later that same day and being stunned by how petite and unintimidating she appeared. How could her murderers have been so threatened by this joyful, faithful woman that they had killed her with such viciousness? For a moment, it was a mind-boggling question, but then I realized that the answer was all too clear in El Salvador. Christina's spirit and activities pushed for fundamental change in El Salvador and helped bring hope to many, a hope for peace and for a just society in which people are not enslaved by fear, by hunger, by illness, by ignorance. Like others who bring such hope, she was a threat to repressive forces there. Her assassins were almost certainly an organized death squad, and evidence suggests that they were related to the Salvadoran Air Force. So what's it like in El Salvador? It's a country at war, as probably most of you know. By the way, let me interject here. If there are questions along the way, you can take some of those. I plan to talk for a little while, and then we'll have time for more open questions. The FMLN is the guerrilla force. Stands for Faramundo Martí National Liberation Front. The FMLN now governs, the government of El Salvador won't admit this, but basically govern in some form or another approximately 30% of the land. Until recently, the war was more in the rural parts of the country. Until November of 1989, some of you may remember that El Salvador made the news every day for a few weeks, probably front page, because of a major offensive launched by the FMLN in the major cities of the country, including San Salvador, launched an offensive as a show of force because of negotiations that continually had been breaking down. And in reference to that, just to give you some more images of what happened during that time. I want to also read just so a few passages from my journal entries during those few weeks. November the 12th. From our second floor windows, we watched as helicopters, push and pull planes, and A-37 jets bombed and strafed FMLN-controlled areas in Santa Marta, Ciudad Creviza, Soyapango and Ilopango to the east, and San Marcos only about 3 kilometers to the south. I watched in awe and horror as the A-37s dove at machine gun and then bombed positions in San Marcos. The explosions were close enough for the sound and vibrations to reverberate throughout our house. They were bombing directly into heavily populated urban areas. I know people who live in the very areas to which bullets and bombs were falling. Stacy in San Marcos, Jim, Bill, and Scott in Creviza, folks in the Baptist Church in Ilopango. I returned November 13th. I returned home around 4:30 p.m., just in time for the late afternoon bombing show. As the daylight waned, we could see tracer bullets spewing from planes over Santa Marta and Soyapango. Since the sound of the guns reached us some seconds after the images of the bullets, the scene reminded me of something out of the Star Wars movie. Little flecks of light with a singleness of purpose descending in silence along an imaginary wire grounded in the battlefield below. November 15th. President Cristiani publicly denied today that the Salvadoran Air Force had done any bombing of heavily populated areas. He claimed that there had only been strafing, and then only in areas in which FMLN forces had been isolated away from civilians. Almost anyone living in the city knows that to be an outright lie. I heard Cristiani's statement on the television news, all carefully censored, of course. only 2 hours after watching the most intense bombing I've seen yet, this time over Ciudad Creviza. I later learned that these were 500-pound bombs. During that time, too, you may remember that the military entered the campus of the University of Central America and pulled out, this was about 5 o'clock in the morning, pulled out of their beds 6 Jesuit priests who were professors, as well as their housekeeper and her daughter, and pulled them out on the lawn and shot them. We'll come back to that at a certain point because it's sad to say that a tragedy like that had to occur for some movement to take place, but a lot of people would now attribute the international pressure that came out of after those assassinations to at least some of the movement that's now taken place in El Salvador in the last 2 years. These are the, I'll pass these around, this is a memorial that was given out at the first anniversary mass after they were killed. Also during that time was a time where there were curfews. I could talk a lot more about that, I won't. But one thing that's particularly striking just about how the atmosphere in El Salvador can be, and especially during that time, were these flyers were distributed in the streets of San Salvador by the Air Force. It basically says, "Patriotic Salvadoran, you have the plain and legitimate right to defend your life and your property, and if for this you have to kill terrorists of the FMLN as well as their international allies, do it. This will be a real victory for the true and only people that need and deserve to live in this country." And it goes on from there. And signed by the Air Force of El Salvador. There were articles every day in the paper asking anyone that saw a foreigner or someone who had a strange accent, which I certainly do in Spanish, to report them. They had a number to call. And a lot of people were deported. Didn't really matter what you were doing there in most cases. Okay, what's it like in El Salvador? Let me just give you a few statistics to put a little bit of things in perspective. First of all, everyone who has a number one, could you stand up? The sheets have one, you have several numbers with slashes in between them, so you're number one, right? Okay, out of this small group here, if we considered all of you on the bottom floor to be the population of El Salvador, she would represent the civilians who have died since 1980. 70,000 civilians have died since 1980 in El Salvador. So if you can imagine, this is a relatively small group of people out of every small group of this size in El Salvador. There has been one person who has been killed as a result of the war. That's not counting all the other diseases and causes of death. Would everyone with number two stand up? That's the two, yes. These people would represent, again, out of this being the population of El Salvador, the number of people who have left the country, who have had to flee the country since 1980. It's about 1 million refugees out of a population of originally around 6 million, which if you put that into U.S. population terms, you can imagine about 4.2 million people out of the United States having to flee the country in the last 10 years. And in addition to that is the number of people who have been internally displaced within the country. Those with number threes. That's three, yeah. These would be the people who have not left the country but who have had to leave their homes, most of whom have come into cities like San Salvador and just live, a lot of them, in cardboard or aluminum shacks or different kinds of materials that they've been able to find to piece together in the ravines of the city. Thank you. Of every 100 persons of working age, we look at unemployment, would the four stand? This is the official government figures for unemployment. It's usually seen as higher than that. And then we can add number fives. The fours, please remain standing. The fives are what other people would be considered underemployment. Basically, these are those of you who are sitting down are the only people in the country that would have basically some semblance of a job. All of you are standing would be at least underemployed, which would mean that you might buy gum and resell it on the streets, or you may get on a bus every day and try to sell little cartoon books, or anything like that. But 70% of the people, at least, and I just saw something else recently that said more like 80-90% of the country do not have regular jobs. Thank you. The average per capita income is $250 a year. And obviously with that, and you look at unemployment, it's not hard to imagine the number of people who cannot meet basic needs, which is essentially the same percentage of about 2/3 of the people cannot meet basic needs in the country. Again, another article that came out in the Miami Herald a few months ago said 90% of the people really cannot meet basic needs. How many of you are over, sorry to ask you this, if you don't want to answer, you don't have to. How many of you are over 45 years of age? Okay, in El Salvador, you are above the average life expectancy. Would number seven stand up? You do not have access to clean water. 50% of the population. The highest, the largest contributor to death, the leading cause of death in El Salvador, is intestinal infection, something almost no one dies of in North America. But diarrhea is a killer in El Salvador, as it is in many other parts of the world. It's people sit down. And at the same time that we have all our 74% of the population has less than 3 years of formal education. At the same time that we look at those statistics, you have to also look at the fact that 2%, or let me ask you here, number eight. Okay. You own 50% of the land in the country. 2% of the population owns 57% of the land, and 20% of the population, represented by number nines, you can sit down. Okay. You control 80% of the resources in the country. Congratulations. Ron's really excited, I would call. And at the same time, and we can't go into a lot of details today, but since the Arena Party has been elected, things have actually gotten worse. That was in June of 1989 that they took power. Elections were in March. And the gap between the rich and poor has actually grown since that time. And of course, the U.S. government supports that the government of El Salvador, controlled by the Arena Party. The U.S. gives over half of the budget to El Salvador. El Salvador is the only country in the world where the national budget comes, more than half of it comes from the United States. We give over $1 million a day, and about 64% of that goes in some form or another towards the war. Come on Thursday, we'll talk about, I think the title of that one is What Your Tax Dollars Pay For in El Salvador. We'll talk more about that. We've given since 1980 about $4.5 billion to the government, and if you count CIA in there, it's about $6 billion is what it amounts to. What's it like in El Salvador? Let's talk about the environment. I mean, that's a real major issue at Holden. We don't usually talk about the environment, maybe, and when we talk about places like El Salvador. Let me just read a couple real brief paragraphs here. El Salvador's environment is the most degraded in Latin America. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the country is undergoing a process of desertification. The National Park Service reports that more than 95% of El Salvador's regional tropical deciduous forests are gone. And today, less than 7% of the country is forested. Deforestation is causing the most serious ecological problems. Slopes and mountains cleared of trees now suffer serious erosion, affecting more than 77% of the country. It goes on from there. And it's very important to recognize that the problems of ecology and environmental concerns in El Salvador are directly tied to the justice concerns. Why is there deforestation? Because poor people are pushed off the good land and end up having to clear land on hillsides so that they can farm anything. You see, and throughout Central America and Guatemala especially, you see fields of corn on hills that we would almost pull out ropes to climb. And also the need for firewood. About 70-something percent of the country cooks with wood. So therefore they have to clear that. So you can't go in and tell a campesino, a peasant person, listen, don't you understand you're destroying the environment? What options do they have unless you also approach ecological concerns and the basic justice concerns? Okay, what's it like in El Salvador? Let me give you just some contrasting images of San Salvador. How many people here, I should ask? I know Dan and Michael have been to San Salvador. Have others been? Carmen? A few people over here. Okay. You find thousands of people that are living in shacks, like I've already mentioned, in the ravines of the city, while in Escalon, you'll find Mercedes. Literally in Escalon, the percentage of Mercedes and BMWs is a higher percentage than it is in the United States. You have shopping malls, supermarkets, expensive jewelry stores. Every house has a wall around it, usually with razor wire top or glass, broken glass. You see beggars in the streets while you find Pizza Hut, McDonald's, which are all, by the way, guarded with people with submachine guns. A few years ago, somebody was shot because they just wanted to take a picture of the fact that it was a North American. Wanted to take a photo of the fact that McDonald's was guarded by two people out front with sawed-off shotguns and machine guns, and they shot him in the leg. The U.S. Embassy is the most fortified building in San Salvador. That's not purely by coincidence. Let me tell you another story. Emilio is 29 and a half years old. He's married, has two daughters. He was a committed husband, father. He was a very active member of a small Baptist church in the rural part of El Salvador, the southern part. He was taking the bus back from San Salvador to his home when the bus was stopped. The military got on. He was taken off and taken immediately to the army base to begin serving in the military. The story goes on. A few weeks later, he specifically said he didn't believe in fighting, that he was a pacifist, and very clearly did not believe in fighting the Salvadoran army, but had no options other than to remain in, but was resistant in what he was doing. At one point, he was hit in the head with a rifle butt, knocked him unconscious. He had a concussion, was in the hospital for a while. Finally, some people in the Baptist church within my work were trying to find if some way of seeing we could maneuver getting him out. It never worked, and he finally deserted. So he lives now, moving from place to place at night so that he can avoid people picking him up. That's something I'll talk more about tomorrow. And we could talk a lot more, too, just about the whole military system, the corruption involved, And why is it that people in the Salvadoran army, especially the, I mean, the officers, really don't want necessarily, at least some of them, an end to the war? They're profiting, becoming very, very wealthy, primarily through U.S. aid that comes in because of the war effort. I'm going to just skip over and do one more thing, and then we'll talk about some of the history and why. Obviously, up until now, I've painted a fairly gruesome picture about what it's like in El Salvador, and I just want to mention, too, that we need to talk about the people. Not all the people, but a core of people that you find there who refuse to give up, who respond to the realities that I just mentioned with a sense of courage and commitment, mostly out of their faith as Christians, who organize themselves in spite of government harassment and in spite of the risk and possible death involved in that, who we have a whole movement in El Salvador right now of refugees who have left the country, who have been in Honduras, in Nicaragua, and Panama for 10 years or so, who are now coming back to the country in spite of the fact that the war is still going on. It's the first time in history that that's ever happened. And they are establishing communities. They have learned to live in community and refugee camps because that was the only way they could survive. And they have negotiated with the government. They have brought pressure to bear by the UN and other countries to the point where they've been allowed to come back. And when they haven't been allowed to come back on their schedule, they've simply come back anyway. In a couple of cases where they simply marched across the border in hundreds and came and resettled. And they are creating a certain kind of model of community living, which is really really mind-boggling in the sense of what they're doing, how they've set up their communities, how they are working together. They are communities which have gone, for instance, when they left the country, I think the literacy rate was probably less than 20%. Now it's over 90%. They've learned skills. They're coming back. They're mechanics. They're farmers. Well, they've always been farmers, but now they've been forced into roles that they have not traditionally done. learning new skills and now kind of trying to contribute to the struggle in El Salvador in which any way they can. They're people who really take the Bible seriously, and I just want to read a section out of Isaiah 65, which we often, I think, sort of look at very symbolically. People in El Salvador take this stuff very concretely, seriously. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant that lives but a few days. We're talking about infant mortality here. We're talking about the fact that 5 times greater infant mortality in El Salvador than the United States. Or an old man who does not fill out his days. The difference between 45 years of life expectancy in El Salvador and 70-something here in the States. For the child shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They're not going to build somebody else's house. They're going to be able to build their own house. They're going to be able to plant and eat of the fields that they have planted and not work on some plantation and then simply get the spoils. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be. My children shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring of the blessing of the Lord and their children with them. And he goes on to talk about the wolf and the lamb shall feed together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord. There's some other how it is that we as North Americans, I think, are sometimes really limited in what we can see in the Bible, and how sometimes we symbolize things that are very concrete for Salvadorans. We can also, we'll talk more about how this whole sense of hope is expressed through the church, and how the church is persecuted as well when we come to a session on Friday. Okay, so let me just spend a few minutes talking about a little bit about why it is that this situation is like it is in El Salvador. A little bit about history, and then we'll open it up from there for questions, and we can talk about anything you'd like. This is going to be very, very brief overall history of El Salvador, but I find in talking about El Salvador that it's absolutely crucial. If to understand the situation in El Salvador, you have to understand the history, and very few articles in the United States really give us that opportunity. In the 1500s, as we all probably know, Spain, as well as other countries in North America, but primarily Spain and Latin America, came in, invaded. You have the Spanish conquest, and we can tell all sorts of stories about how essentially 90% of the indigenous population within the first 100 years of the conquest were eradicated, some through disease, some through war, whatever. So Spain gave certain land to large landowners for various reasons, favors, family connections, whatever, all through Central America, all through Latin America for that matter. So a small group of elite really controlled a lot of the land. But it was primarily land along the coast of El Salvador. I know this is a very small map, but we don't have a better one. You can really divide El Salvador generally into three geographical zones. One right along the coast, which is lowlands, very fertile, pretty flat. And then right through the middle of the country, which is where San Salvador is, Santa Ana, you have more of the middle section of hills. And then the upper part is much more mountainous, right along the Honduran border. This is Honduras here, Guatemala here. This land was the land that the people from Spain really wanted the most, because it was fertile. One of the first products grown was indigo, which was used to make dyes. So it was sent back to Europe to make blue dyes for all of the aristocracy in different parts of Europe. In 1820, so go along for a couple hundred years, and that's primarily the way things stand. There's still people, indigenous populations that live up more in this part of the country, who still have some control of communal lands and farm their own land and can farm enough food to live off of themselves. In 1821, all of Central America and Mexico declared their independence from Spain, and there was then Central America was declared itself independent from Mexico, and so we had the Central American states that were one country at that particular point. But then between 1821 and 1842, everyone was fighting each other until finally in 1842, by that time you have Central America broken up into more or less the way it is now. There was some differences in Nicaragua and all that. But in 1842 you have El Salvador becoming an independent country. Then this is absolutely key to understanding El Salvador, as well as Guatemala, Honduras, other places, is in the mid-1800s, coffee became the big product in Central America. Now that means several things. First of all, they're finding other things for dyes, to use for dyes in Europe. So indigo is no longer needed as much. Everybody now in Europe, it's the real fashionable thing to do is to drink coffee. So everyone's into that, so we gotta find places to grow coffee. Now, there's several things that become consequences of that. Number one, Coffee, where's coffee grown?
Mountains.
In the mountains or on the hillside, you know, you see all these Colombian coffee commercials on television, they always have it mountain grown. It's not grown in the lowlands. So all of a sudden, the people who control all these big plantations down here, you know, they still can grow things on here, and there's a lot of cotton grown along there, the sugar cane now. But coffee was the biggie. So they're going to want land through here. Well, when the powerful want land in a certain place, they go out and they arrange ways to get it. So there was a gradual process of people buying up land, forcing people off the land, and they even used legal means, quote unquote, of doing that between 1876 and 1881. There were a series of laws passed in El Salvador which basically made it illegal to have communal lands. Now, these are indigenous people who have for generations and generations and generations lived communally. They didn't own private land. They shared land and they grew their crops in a certain way as a community. Well, now all of a sudden, you can't have communal lands. Who's going to be able to afford to maintain and buy land? It's obviously going to be the people who are already the elite in the country. So there's a gradual process by which people who have had at least some access to growing their own food now have less access to land. The other thing that's important, which is all worked into this, is that coffee is a very labor-intensive crop. You need a lot of people when the beans are ready to pick them. So other laws were passed that basically forced people into working on coffee plantations, especially at certain times of the year, and then they could go back when the labor wasn't needed. So there's a whole series of things that work together to consolidate more and more the control of the land into the hands of a few and take away access to land for growing crops from the peasants themselves. After that, you have a whole system that grows up to protect that very system of land control. In 1912, the National Guard, which is infamous in El Salvador, was started specifically to protect landowners from protests, from possible takeovers from workers, from agitating workers, whatever. Throughout these last 100 years, there have been a number of protests, of uprisings by peasants in the country. The war going on now is not the first time that's happened, and that's very, very important to understand. This is not like some new kind of thing. It's not because there's Soviet Union and Cuba, which is what we always want to hear or are told. In 1932 is probably the most well-known of those uprisings. It was led by Farabundo Martí, from which the name of the guerrilla wars now comes. He organized campesinos. Campesinos is the Spanish name for peasant or farmer. Primarily indigenous population at that point, and they marched unarmed, peacefully, into San Salvador at one point of about 4,000 or 5,000 people, and they were shot down in the streets. And hundreds of people were killed on that particular day. Later on, Farabundo Martí was arrested, was tracked down, captured, and executed. But after that particular day, after there had been a series of organized events going on, after that particular day, in the next, I've heard the next 2 months, anywhere from 15,000 to 30,000 indigenous campesinos were assassinated in El Salvador by the order of Martinez, who was the president, the military dictator at that time. And essentially, from that point on, the indigenous population of El Salvador has ceased to exist as it was in the past. If you've ever been to Central America, you go to Guatemala, and over half of the population are indigenous almost pure indigenous people. In El Salvador, it's less than 10%. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that there was already some trend in that direction before, but especially after that, no one wanted, they were scared to death to dress in indigenous costumes. There has been more intermarriage since then, although there had been some up until that time. There had been less, there was still less than in Guatemala. In 1944, I'm skipping over a lot of things here about how Martinez came into power, but he was overthrown in 1944. But still, there was a whole series of military dictators up until the 70s. In 1972 and 1977, you had fraudulent elections where very, very clearly the opposition candidates, Democratic candidates, won in 1972, for those of you who know the history of El Salvador in the last 10 years, was Duarte, who did become president in 1984. He was the candidate in 1972, along with Guillermo Ungo, who died not too long ago, and became a major sort of leader in the opposition in El Salvador. They were elected, but the army refused to let them take power, and the army maintained the dictatorship. Similar thing happened in 1977, when the people protested that in the middle of San Salvador, and stayed in a plaza for several days and nights. Finally, in about the fourth night, the army came in, surrounded everyone, and opened up fire on people. This is in 1977. The 1970s are marked by the sort of coming to consciousness more and more of popular organizations, of people protesting the situation in El Salvador, people, Salvadorans protesting that, and being met almost at every turn by massacres and by repression. And I could go through a whole list of times that students have been simply shot down in the streets when they've marched without weapons, of times, one time it was caught on international television when people were on the steps of the cathedral and the National Guard simply drove trucks up, lined soldiers up in front of the people sitting on the steps, and just raised their guns up and started firing. And that was in early 1980. In 1979, you had a coup by young officers. There was some hope that a combined junta of civilian and military leaders could actually get the country back on some democratic track, but the military maintained control. Civilian members of that junta eventually withdrew out of protest and reverted back to a situation of a military dictatorship. And that point, probably as much as anything else, is when a lot of people who for years had been working nonviolently finally came to the decision, for them at least, that they saw no hope in a nonviolent movement in El Salvador and went to armed revolution. There were already guerrilla movements in the country in the 1970s, but that's when five different military groups consolidated into what is now known as the FMLN. In the last 10 years now, we have a war. I've already talked a little bit about the offensive in November. And just to sort of finish up to say, the situation now in El Salvador is one in which the offensive of November of 1989 did several things. Number one, it impressed upon the world that the FMLN was not a defeated force. That's what the Salvadoran government and the U.S. government had been telling everyone, that the FMLN is defeated, it's just a matter of time before we rid them. It became very clear that they were not. It also became very clear that the FMLN could not win militarily, that neither side could win militarily. And finally, people on both sides had to finally admit that. It also showed, with the assassination of the Jesuits and the kind of response that the armed forces of El Salvador made to the offensive in terms of bombing indiscriminately, that they no longer, that the U.S. could no longer hold up the image of this reprofessionalized army that had learned about human rights and had learned to control itself. So there's a lot of international attention and pressure that came to bear on that. So basically, you have now finally come to a point where there are serious negotiations in the country. And there, I'm not naive, and I don't want to be overly optimistic. I think that there's a long road ahead. But I do think that the situation in the country has changed and is irreversible in the sense of moving in another direction. That's primarily due to global changes. It's due to international pressure that's now coming to bear through the UN as well as through other sources. But the UN now has finally accepted a major role, and that does make a big difference in negotiations. I think there could be a ceasefire in the country, say within 6 months to a year. But I also think that even with a ceasefire, that we're going to experience a backlash from the ultra-right. It's already started. There's a lot of fighting going on now because both sides that are negotiating are trying to use their military leverage as a way of leverage in the talks themselves. And so when I left 1st of June, I'm here in the States just for about 2.5 months. The war was as heavy as it had been in a long time. Several times attacks were made right in the city, fairly close to where I live. I think that there could also be major economic problems. I think one of the concerns of Salvadorans is that the same thing is going to happen to them that happened in Nicaragua, that let's say there is a ceasefire and there really is some movement. In Nicaragua, finally the war was over and everybody, their feeling is everyone abandoned them. And all the aid that the U.S. put into the Contra war, none of that, very little of it has ever come to rebuild the country. There's a lot more I could say, but we have about 12 more minutes. A little bit longer than I planned to go to start with. Let me just stop there and open it up for questions. Talk about that. For some of you, that's probably a review of things that you all already knew before the. I hope that at least that's been helpful to set the stage for some of the other things that come. It's a very, very brief introduction. Yes.
Give me the name for the FML again. What does it stand for?
In English, it would be the bottom. Write it up here. Maribundo Martí is the name of the person who led the rebellion in 1932, and it would just be the National Liberation Front. Maribundo Martí, National Liberation Front. This would be Frente Maribundo Martí, Liberté y Liberación.
What is the FMLN's position? What were their hopes trying to get the communal lands back, or what is their hope for?
What are their goals?
Yes.
Okay. That's an excellent question. I think they've changed over the last few years. In 1980, 81, 82, well up to 1987, 88 probably, the goal of the FMLN was to overthrow the government in El Salvador, the military dictatorship, and take control to establish within the leadership, it's not necessarily a completely homogeneous group ideologically, but certainly at the top levels you would have more of a socialist, Marxist ideology, but also with a lot of people that would not see themselves completely boxed in that way. In the lower, the people who are actually fighting, you have everything, people who don't necessarily talk about Marxism or understand that, but a lot of people would even express it out of being Christian. Now we might, you know, there are also people who are very much in a non-violent camp in El Salvador. One point is to say you can't completely reduce El Salvador to two sides, the FMLN and the government. There's a whole group in between who are struggling non-violently to bring change. Their goals would be, though, would be justice, of a system that's more equitable, they would express that more in socialist kinds of terms, at least originally more so than now. Now they're very careful to use rhetoric that is more democratic. They are very sensitive in the sense that the situation in the world has changed with the changes in Eastern Europe. And even though I would maintain, and most people would too, that they are not totally dependent on, have not been created by the Soviet bloc, nor have they been completely maintained by that. It's a popular uprising which would have occurred regardless of whether there was that or not. Their goals, more recently in negotiations, are to establish guarantees that they can enter the political process and really truly have some power. And they basically have conceded that they're not going to be able to overthrow the government. So what they're fighting for are primarily constitutional reforms. These are the primary issues right now in the negotiations. Constitutional reform, judicial reform, electoral reform, and the biggie is purification, is usually the word used, of the military. Their argument is, the government just says, hey, we'll be really nice to you, and you can lay down your arms, and we'll forget everything you did, and you can come and join the political process. Well, that would be suicide, is that what they would say, is that as long as the military is in control of the country, there will never be true reform. And elections don't necessarily mean anything in that kind of situation. So they are negotiating for guarantees that they want to demilitarize the whole country, have a system like Costa Rica. Now they've backed off a little bit, realize they're not going to get that far, so that at least some kind of complete change in the military structure, changes in the electoral system, and then they say, if we have that, some basics, we'll agree to a ceasefire, and then after the ceasefire, we could have another year or two of negotiating these other reforms, and once we feel like we have guarantees that we could safely enter the process, then we'll do that. And they say, we know we have enough support in the country to have major influence in making change. So they're concerned that what happened in Colombia, you had the guerrilla group who entered the political process, and the first election, something like, I don't remember, I think it was 1,000? No, I don't remember how many of the originally guerrilla candidates were assassinated in the first open election. So, say we're not going to do that.
Yeah, I have two questions. First of all, where does the FMLN get its extrinsic support, and what effect is the breakup of the Eastern Bloc and communist world, in a way, what effect will that have? Secondly, what is the real interest of the United States in El Salvador?
Oh, okay. I'm going to do a whole session on the last question on Thursday. I don't know if you'll be here or not. Let me start. The first one was
FMLN support. Where does it get extrinsic?
Well, obviously, depending on who you talk to, you get very different stories about that. My own sense is that there's clearly support from the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and things that have been channeled through Nicaragua, and they've basically admitted that. And there's some support from Cuba. There has been some support from the Soviet Union. That seems to be less now. There's also a lot of support from solidarity groups in Europe. There's a lot of money that seems to come in from groups in different, not only in Europe, but some in the United States. But a lot of money that comes in from non-governmental groups that support their revolution. Other things that happen, I sort of love this story. About a little less than a year ago, there was a big thing about a couple Sandinistas officers had sold SAM missiles, which is a major change in the war, because the main advantage that the Salvadoran Army and Air Force have had is that they have air power and the guerrillas don't have any of that. So as soon as all of a sudden they got portable surface-to-air missiles, this really changed the nature of the war. Well, there's a big deal about that, and there was all this pressure for the guerrillas to give back their missiles. They're sure they're going to give back. Well, they came out there and announced, they said, okay, we'll give them back. So they had this big thing where they had a couple, I think the ambassador from Mexico and from some other mutual country came up to a place called Perkin, which is basically FMLA in control territory. And they had this big press conference, and they were going to give back. I think they gave all except for two of them back. At the same time they gave back the Soviet-made SAM missiles, they demonstrated for the journalist the red-eye, U.S.-made red-eye missiles that they just bought from ex-Contras from Nicaragua. At one point, it was said that the largest source of arms for the FMLN were buying arms from the Contras that the U.S. supplies in Nicaragua. Because the Contras were getting sort of fed up. You got an M16, you can sell it. At one point people said you could buy an M16 on the streets of Tegucigalpa in Honduras for $60. Now, that's obviously not where all their stuff has come from, but it's a conglomeration of a lot of stuff. Second question about Eastern Bloc is there's no doubt that changes the nature of the situation, and it has clearly been one of the factors that has moved the FMLN to the negotiating table. That they don't get all their support from there, but they get some, and it's also changed the nature of the dialogue in terms of the way they talk. They clearly want to separate themselves from and they have been doing this for years actually, from a strictly Soviet form of Marxism or of socialism. And they say, we want to create a kind of system that is Salvadoran. But they've even done that more so since the changes in Eastern Europe. What is U.S. interest? I'll do this in 30 seconds. I can't do that in 30 seconds. I think that it's really not, there are not major economic interests there. So people say, well, why are we so concerned? I think that a lot of it has to do with the U.S. sort of mentality about control in the world. And some of it is clearly related to a communist, anti-communist kind of ideology. But that's less so now, obviously, because, you know, what do you identify as the enemy? And that has changed to some degree the U.S. role. The U.S. now is more supportive of negotiations than they were before. They always negotiate. The U.S. basically sabotaged negotiations up until about a year or so ago. But I think it has to do with basically control, and the New World Order that we hear so much about is basically controlling people in the world. And I don't think that's necessarily conscious on a lot of people's parts, but that's the way it all works. And if you're here on Thursday, we can talk a lot more about that. Thanks for coming.